the Mud Puppy Games Network.
This podcast contains spoilers and mature content.
Hello, is anyone there?
Calling anyone out there. This is Found in the Ruins.
Welcome, Wasteland Warriors, to the Found in the Ruins podcast, a podcast about the post-apoc in all its many forms. And remember, at Found in the Ruins, survivor isn't just a word, it's a noun. I am Boom Mike, and I am joined by Doc Benny.
Hi, everyone.
And we are reviewing a book today, Pulp Apocalypse. A nonfiction book that covers what the author calls the men's adventure novels of the 70s and 80s, early 90s. Almost all apocalyptic goodness, various ways, various forms. We'll talk about it in more detail, but first, do we have any emails?
Why, yes, we do. Thank you for asking. All right, the first email today comes from Jeffrey S. Loved the Found in the Ruins episode. Can't wait to see what shows up in later episodes. Love the 80s stuff, but also a fan of the classics like A Canticle for Leibowitz and Earth Abides. Also, it was a bit odd not hearing Liz, Corbett, and Jim with you. So I noticed that my name was left out of that sentence. So
the part of Liz is currently being played by Doc Benny.
That's right. I am a man of many talents.
Ironically, the gentleman who emailed there, it was his feed on Facebook that first notified me of the existence of the book Pulp Apocalypse. So good on you, Jeff. We appreciate it.
That's very nice. That's very nice to know. Thank you for the email, Jeff. We have another email from a second Jeff. Last name initial is R. Dear Mike and Bob. So I also go by the name of Bob, if that's what you prefer. I just listened to the first
Bob
episode.
Bob is short for Ben.
It is. Doc Benny is too long of a word, so we just go with Bob. That's fine. All right. I just listened to the first episode of your new project, and I have to say that I'm really excited about it. I really like the fantasy genre and Dungeons & Dragons, of course. However, my very favorite game is Gamma World First Edition. As a Gen X of a certain age, I grew up being led to believe that by now we would all either be dead or fighting the cannibal sex cult bikers, which we talked about last week, for the last case of bottled water, waist deep in the bones of our loved ones. In the past, as now, I found comfort in reading books like Andre Norton's No Night Without Stars and Starman's Son, or Sterling's hero novels, or A Canticle for Leibowitz, and playing Gamma World, of course. I'm not sure exactly why, but I think it has to do with the fact that the apocalypse isn't necessarily the end. The idea that life, though different, will go on. I always really enjoy the idea of digging into the ruins to find things that ancients left behind, whether they are useful or not. I look forward to hearing further podcasts in this regard. Thank you for doing this. Keep your Type 5 blasters ready. Signed, Jeffrey R.
Thanks. And by the way, that reminds me, Benny, I wanted to say, really good of you to race into the bunker just for the leather-clad sex cult cannibals got you. I mean, you've still got it, man. You had that sprint.
I've got the sprint speed, but I forgot to lock the door, so I'm a different man today.
Oh, man.
Okay.
Anyway, our next email.
Yep. One more email. So this is from Alexander D. Now, I'm going to preface this by saying that he asks that we read in a voice like Worm Tongue, if you can. And I'm going to go ahead and say that all of my voices sound like a cross between Gollum and Yoda.
Is that a lightsaber in your pocket?
Or just have... You are. Yeah.
So betray Roland, I will.
Yes, I don't really and can't really do justice to Wormsung, so I apologize. But now on to the email. How often, if at all, do you, C-O-Y's Learned Men of the Apocalypse, that's what we are now, apparently, pedal bikes as opposed to motorcycles, like 10 speeds or dirt bikes used by anyone in the post-apocalyptic adventures you have stumbled upon. Are you going to cite appendices that inspired certain post-apoc games at points in your walkthrough as a vein of what was going on in the creators' heads? That's a very interesting question. I have a comment about the bikes, but Mike, did you want to chime in first?
Well, thanks for the email. And funny, you know, we were talking about this right after it came in, but just past couple of days, I had started a new series of books, The World All in Darkness by Jack Hunt. It's really interesting. They all try to use bikes after an EMP, but it's like every hero gets to use a bike for a little while, then gets beat up and has the bike taken from them every single time. Maybe sorta, I guess?
Basically, what I can add to that, I recently rewatched the movie adaptation of World War Z, and at one point, the main character travels to a military base in South Korea to try to find Patient Zero, where special forces have actually learned to use bikes to get around because the Zeeks, which is their colloquial term for zombies, are attracted to any type of sound. So engines, for instance, would drive them in hordes. So all of our heroes and these special ops soldiers, you know, with these huge backpacks and all their gear hanging over, are kind of bent over these 10-speed bikes, biking through the military base to try to get around safely without attracting the attention of the zombies. So I thought that was really an interesting...
So yeah, just basically off the shelf kind of 10 speeds.
Yep, exactly. I don't see it very often, just like Mike said, he saw one recently. But in situations like that, I mean, you could argue that there's a point that a bicycle for at least short distances, recon, things like that, going out to, you know, raid a store or whatever for supplies, bikes would actually be beneficial because there's no significant sound that's going to alert the baddies to your presence. So I like that question. It's a very good question. Thank you for asking.
And they're easier to maintain.
Yeah. I mean, yes. They don't need gasoline that lasts 40 years.
Right. And you don't have to keep tuning up the motors and whatnot. But on the other hand, you know, you're vulnerable. Of course, you're pretty vulnerable on a motorcycle too. So, all right. Well, and that's all the emails?
That is the three we're going to do today.
Okay. Yeah, we got some more, but we're saving that for Ep 3. And if you want to write us, you can write us at foundintheruins@gmail.com. And if you don't want your name used, be sure to put in the email just to be safe, so we don't inadvertently blurt out a name and you don't want that name used. So, all right then. Well, let's talk about, well, actually, we need to talk about the last book and movies we've seen most recently. And I'll start. My books, I'm going to put two in because I, you know me, I have no life. So I was able to finish two since the last episode. It was a new one and an old one. The new one is called A Boy and His Dog at the End of the World by Charlie Fletcher, published in 2019. This is not the Harlan Ellison Boy and His Dog. This is different. It is an ecological / fertility apocalypse where the human race is pretty much dying out. The main character lives on an island with his family. A stranger comes by, drugs them, and steals his dog. So he has to go out after him to get the dog back. And they're on the Outer Hebrides in North Scotland. So basically has to follow to the mainland, and traveling around, you get to see what's left. They don't quite say how long it's been, but it's been at least 50, maybe 100 years. It's a decent book. It's a good book. It didn't knock my socks off, but it didn't stink either. But what I would say that really stood out to me about it was, apparently while growing up, this kid had access to another island's library, and he had read the entire post-apocalyptic part of it. So all through the book, the main character is talking to the photo of this boy, girl, and their dog from before the apocalypse, like they're having a conversation, and thus, by definition, talking to you, the reader. And they keep mentioning, you know, that, oh, well, you know, you had some of it right in Earth Abides, but you got a lot of it wrong. And there hasn't been a single Triffid, but I kind of hope I don't run into any on the mainland, because that would be terrible. And just mentioning all the classics. So that's cute. Little Easter egging there, which I found amusing. The other one is called Down to a Sunless Sea by David Graham. in 1981, and it is about the dark, bitter future of 1985. You remember that? In 1985, the oil was all used up. New York was like the movie The Warriors or Escape from New York, only dark and grim.
Only dark and grim.
There's a nuclear war over the few remaining bits of oil left in the world, and thus there's the radiation, and the main characters are on a jet, a passenger jet that's trying to stay away from the clouds of radiation while trying to find places to refuel and a safe zone to live in.
Hmm.
So it was pretty good. It was sort of like On the Beach, if you've read it, only yes. It's rather more realistic in dealing with how fallout and radiation works. It was 1981, so they still didn't bother to pay attention to electromagnetic pulse. But it also had some vibes of a Netflix series I saw called Into the Night.
I was just about to mention that.
Only this was good. I mean, okay, Into the Night wasn't awful.
To be fair, the Netflix series had its moments. Like when the stewardess got off the plane at one of the refueling sites and was basically stranded by some of the bad guys and left behind. And, you know, the premise of that was that as soon as the sunlight touched you, you basically dropped dead. And
because
so
of gamma rays.
Gamma rays. Yeah. And so it had its interesting moments, but it did leave a lot to be desired, unfortunately.
And that was about the only likable character in the first 6 to 8 episodes. And they killed her like in episode 2.
Yeah, they did.
And I'm like, it wasn't that it was a bad premise or a bad series, but it's like, I hate everyone. By episode 4, I'm rooting for the sun. Kill them, kill them, kill them. What books did you read? Or book, I should say.
So interestingly, I went a different direction and I reviewed several series by one of my favorite authors growing up, Terry Brooks. Most people have probably heard about the Shannara series. And by series, I mean, there are, you know, 30 odd books.
Yeah. Parking Meters of Shannara.
Yeah. The interesting thing is that the first 6 or 7 books, it seems like it's this beautifully built up fantasy world that works really well. There's the different races, there's magic, things like that. And at the same time, he had written a separate 3-book series, which was set in modern times called The Word in the Void. And that didn't seem to have any tie-in, but his 6th or 7th series eventually came around to the fact that the current day series then evolved into a post-apocalyptic setting, which he had a 3-book series for that, which ended up tying in the entire fact that the current worlds that we were reading about, the current civilizations in the Shannara series, were actually 1,000 years after the Great Wars had destroyed the world, and it was actually all set on Earth at a future date. And so the interesting conundrum that I had with this was, what do you call it? I mean, obviously the 3-book series that was in modern times would be a pre-apocalypse series. And then the 3-book series that was kind of the tie-in where they were living in the ruins, that's obviously post-apoc. But then the books that are 1,000 years in the future, you know, 1,000 years later, where they've got this thriving fantasy society, is that post-apoc? Is that dystopian? Or is that just a standalone fantasy series that just happens to be tied to this event that happened 1,000 years earlier? So I'm kind of curious what you think about that, Mike.
I'd go with the last. I mean, because realistically, fantasy, at least traditional Western fantasy, tends to be based in a pseudo-medieval Europe. And what was medieval Europe but the post-apoc from the Roman Empire, right?
Right. But no one considers it a post-apoc at that point. They just consider it the society, right? I mean, it is a new society.
Yeah, and I think it's kind of how we were talking last time, that if there's a fully functioning society that isn't just a repeat of the pre-apocalypse society, then it's no longer a post-apocalypse. It's dystopian if it's a bad society, or it's just humanity moving on if it's a good society.
Yeah, I like that description, and I think I agree with you on that.
But yeah, from what you were talking about, it sounds a lot like Jack Vance's Dying Earth and Thundar the Barbarian, you know, and I've heard people describe post-apoc, at least the traditional, you know, post-nuclear, Road Warrior, Beyond Thunderdome, or stuff like that, as basically fantasy novels. But instead of a baseline of medieval-ish Europe type thing, the baseline is the modern day.
Hmm.
But it incorporates a lot of the fantasy tropes.
It does. But for me, I would still backpedal and call that post-apoc slash dystopian. It's a very fine line. And that's why I think it's an interesting topic, because at what point does it move from one to the next, right?
Yeah.
Because for the first 7 books of the Shannara series, it's its own world. And you never once stop to think, hey, this might be a post-apoc dystopian setting. And then you kind of gradually find out later when he ties everything together. So I found that fascinating. So I went back and read excerpts from many of the books in the series just to refamiliarize myself with the storyline.
And roll it all together. That's reasonable. Yep. Okay. Movies. The latest post-apoc movie I have watched was I Am Mother off Netflix. And I can't honestly decide if it was post-apoc or dystopian. It had aspects of both. It was a nifty story. Also an excellent reason why artificial intelligence is a bad thing. But I got to salute whoever made the movie, because they basically made an entire movie with 2 actresses. That's it.
Yeah.
I mean, the baby, I suppose you could count as an actor, but seriously. And whoever was doing the voice of Mother. So, all right, 4 cast. That's all you had.
Yeah.
And some robots.
Impressive. Well, and interesting. I mean, the second human character, so the second, you know, full on screen actress didn't even really show up until the later parts of the story.
Yeah, she didn't show up till mid-story. And yeah, the main character was kind of in a dystopian, except she wasn't really aware she was in a dystopian. And it was only contacting the survivor that she realized, wait, maybe I'm in a dystopia. And then it goes on and sex, lies, and videotapes. Okay, there's no sex, but there are lies and videotape. So what did you watch?
Well, I was going to say that raises the question of if there's a dystopian society in the forest and if a tree falls, does anyone hear it?
No, because they'll be shot for trying to hear it. That's double plus bad and not permitted by Big Brother.
So what did I watch? Although in the movie, it was actually Big Mother, not Big Brother. But I get your point.
That's true. Although if it's in the forest, would it be Big Smokey?
Big Smokey.
Only you.
We could play this game all day long. So the movie that I watched, getting off track here for a second, was something called Mortal Engines, which was actually based on a novel from the early 2000s. It's essentially, it's a post-apoc slash dystopian movie where approximately 1,000 years after they called it the 60-minute war because they had new technology and they used quantum energy weapons to basically instantly vaporize most of the world. And the people that are left have banded together and they've rebuilt cities. But what they've done is they've rebuilt cities onto these giant tank treads. So they're mobile cities. It reminded me of something from the game Ogre. It was something on that scale or maybe even larger. And these mobile cities would go around eating the smaller cities and basically incorporating the people into their population and taking all the resources off the cities that they would ingest to keep their city powered up. And so it was fascinating because they found out towards the end of the movie that there's actually behind this thing called the Shield Wall, there's actually a society of actual, like a city that's set in place behind the safety of the Shield Wall. But on the other side of the Shield Wall, it's still full on post-apocalyptic with these motorized cities running around and just eating everything they can. So I thought it was interesting because it was very dystopian society if you're on one of the cities, but if you're like one of the raiders or scavengers, you're full on post-apoc, just trying to survive in the wasteland of what used to be Great Britain or some other part of the world.
So the people behind the Shield Wall in that city, it's kind of a haves and have-nots kind of thing?
Well, so they present it as a utopia type of setting. So once you get behind the Shield Wall, there's no deserts, there's no wasteland, everything. They've got
That's
plants,
what I mean.
They've got orchards, yeah.
So if you live there, things are great.
Right, if you're in there. But the problem is they have to constantly defend themselves from these roving cities on the outside. And the people on the, it's the classic storyline where the only people that actually know the truth are the ones who are in charge of the cities. Like all the citizens that are living in these mobile cities, they think that's all there is to the world. They have no idea right. that there's a whole other, you know, settlement of humanity living in relative peace and comfort and normalcy to some degree behind the shield wall.
Well, that's usually the trick. All right. Well, now that we've updated everybody in that, let's talk about Pulp Apocalypse.
All right, you primitive screwheads, listen up.
Pulp Apocalypse. It was published in 2020, and Eric Paperback Warrior Compton kind of head honchoed it, but there are several authors with various articles or reviews, and it's, I think part of them were originally taken from his website, paperbackwarrior.com. We'll have a link in the show notes. Oh, which reminds me, by the way, also, if there are any fans of the audio podcast drama We're Alive out there, the zombie apoc, there's a Kickstarter going on to handle the last two seasons to end the series. It's been going on for like 8 or 9 years at least, and has had a couple of spinoffs. So we'll put that link in the show notes too. I probably should have mentioned that at the beginning. Oh well. But yeah, Paperback Warrior has compiled a fairly comprehensive list of the men's adventure novels of the post-apoc from the 70s, 80s, early 90s. It's not a huge book. It's only a little over 100 pages. It's got some good info in there. Some I wish he would have gotten a little more into detail of, but we'll talk about that. But what was your first impression, Benny?
He did a really good job of giving short but really in-depth reviews of all of the books that he focused on and all the series that he focused on. And it was enough that if you read the reviews, you kind of came away saying, hey, that's something that's down my alley, or, you know, that's something that I wouldn't touch with a 10-foot pole. So I really liked that, how detailed he was.
Yeah, I wish he would have covered The Guardians, though, by Richard Austin.
I noticed that was not in there, which is interesting, because that was probably one of the first series that you and I read.
It's listed in the back, in the overall alphabetical list of stuff. But yeah, he doesn't talk about it in any way, which is unfortunate. Because they went, 9-10 books, right?
Yeah. It was a long-running series.
He covered a couple that were much smaller than that.
Some of these were even single novels that he covered.
Yeah, that didn't go very far. And when you were talking about how Brooks combined Shannara like that, all these different series into one big whole, that reminded me of, was it David Robbins, who apparently did that with the Blade series and his Mountain Man?
Yep, Mountain Man and Blade series, yep.
Yeah, there's an interview with Dave Alexander and David Robbins. Alexander, I think, did the Phoenix series. There was not an interview with Lawrence James, the author of several post-apoc series, most notably Deathlands, as James Axler. But they did give some information on him and how he managed to get involved doing some of the books. Also made me want to consider looking into some of his other series, like that Survival 2000. But, of course, got to find them.
It's interesting. Multiple times there were comments about how a series would be started by one author, and they might write books 1, 2, and 5, for instance, and then the company would want a faster timeline, or that author would go on to a different project temporarily, and so they would bring in a second or a third writer. So a lot of these longer series actually had multiple writers that were doing different parts of the books and different books within the series. So I thought that was really kind of interesting. So some of these long-running series, they might use the same pen name, but it's not necessarily the same author who actually wrote all this stuff.
Yeah, that harkens back to the old days of the pulps. And Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew did that as well. You would have just the house name, and everyone would write under the house name. For instance, Deathlands, I think, had at least 7 or 8 different authors, some more than others. But and reading that section made me realize I have read over 100 of the 125 Deathlands novels, and isn't that sad?
But you're a better man for it.
Yeah, that's it, isn't it? Let's say it is. Yeah. I will say this, though. I bought on Graphic Audio the audio dramas, dramatizations of a lot of the Deathlands books. And I also got one called Doomsday Warrior, which I just got the first book. And I didn't get any more because it was so goofy, over the top, weird. Ted Roxon. and they talk about the history of the author, Jan Stacy, who wrote that series. And he was like a guitar-playing hippie from Central Park. And I'm like, really? And he's writing these what amounts to male romance novels? Yeah. But okay, I guess whatever works. But I learned that wasn't the weirdest. Swampmaster, anyone?
Oh, yeah, with the acrobatic. Is that the one with the acrobatic dwarves and the killer radiated, mutated clowns? Yes.
Yep.
That was a fun.
Dun, dun, a fun dun, 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 dun.
Actually, that one was interesting. Not so he reviews. So the author does a good job of reviewing the different novels, but he's also brutally honest in some situations about stuff that he would recommend or not recommend, which I thought was really funny. Tongue in cheek, obviously.
Yeah, he was talking about the Survivalist series by Jerry and Ahern and his wife. I had never read those. In fact, most of these I had never read until maybe 5-10 years ago.
Yeah.
Because we pretty much just read Guardians and that was it. And of course, that's one he didn't cover. But anyway, I bought the first book off Amazon and read it. And they're right. You know, if you play it as a drinking game and every time you hear Daytonics 45, Twin Shoulder Rig, or Rubberized Mylar Grips and drink, you are toasted well before that book's over. And it's not a big book.
That reminded me of something. I have to read. So I'm not going to say what book he was talking about, but this one quote that he's reviewing, he says, I hope that enough copies have been mutilated, burned, shredded, or lost through the course of book closing and shopping mall abandonment. This book has no place in this world. The author will forever be known as he who created the horror. And then this book is utterly awful. But he's being genuinely honest. And if he likes something, he'll say it. And if he doesn't like something, he'll come out and say it too. And I really like that because it makes the reviews more realistic.
And there's several authors of different things. So you're not just getting one person's view, which is also good. Although some books are so bad, they're good. So all that review immediately makes me want to go, maybe I should try the first one just to see. Is this so bad it's good, or is it just bad?
Yeah, no, that is fair. That is fair.
But yeah, it's got some good stuff. I will say Lawrence James is not shiny, happy people. One, he's British. Check episode one about British post-apoc. And second, he used to write a lot of Westerns in the 70s, which on occasion really shines through in the Deathlands books. There are some of those books that if you just turn Ryan Cotter and his friends into gunslingers and mutants into Apaches, it's a Western. First, last, and totally a Western. And, you know, you can make the argument to a degree all post-apocalyptic could be translated as slightly Western. But this is literally, you could just change those and it's a Western.
Yeah, I agree with you. that reminded me of another quote from one of these reviews that I just had to share because it made me laugh so much. This is absolute garbage. If garbage was alive and had a waste can that it could put its own garbage in, this book would be the filth-ridden wallpaper adorning the can's inner aluminum shell.
Wow!
When he doesn't like something, he pulls no punches. And I really, again, it makes it, so it's not a boilerplate review. Like, he really, honestly, like the ones he likes, he really praises them. And the ones he doesn't like, he has fun with words. Let's just put it that way.
Don't beat around the bush. Tell us what you really think.
But really, yeah. Jeez.
Another thing they cover is they don't limit themselves to American. They cover some British, Spanish, and German, like Waste World and In World, I think are a couple of British ones. There's one that's German called Madrax. And even though I think it was in the late 80s that it came out, I don't remember for sure. It reads almost like something you would read, prose form, something you would have read regularly in heavy metal in the late 70s.
Right. And I was just going to point out that we hadn't talked about heavy metal yet, because that was, I mean, a lot of these stories might have even come from heavy metal.
Yeah, one of them, Hombre, was a Spanish one that seemed to be. And it was fun, apparently, because it covered the same post-apoc tropes. But the main character, Hombre, isn't a Snake Plissken-looking Ryan Cardor or Arnold Schwarzenegger, Ted Roxon. You know, he's this middle-aged guy with a mustache and a beer belly. It's like, this is dude, you know, every dude. And I think that's pretty cool.
It is every dude. And apparently, I guess some of the artwork for that would show him full-on naked with his old man beer belly and balls. Like, I love that. I love that because it's so, it's realistic. And that's a hero you can get behind because you're like, that's like, yeah, I mean, that's my life right there.
Somebody, a book I read several months ago, it was nonfiction and it was called Scarring and Disability in Mad Max. And it basically was an academic review of various terrible disabilities that showed up in the Mad Max movies. And I hadn't really thought about it until I read that book. And it's like, yeah, you think about it. There's people whose legs don't work. Max's knee is screwed up. People have limbs chopped off or horribly scarred or just, yeah. I mean, that kind of seemed to go hand in hand with post-apoc. Well, yeah. Furioso and Fury Road.
Oh, yeah, right. I mean, she's driving around with her little hook.
Yeah.
In the main rig. Yeah, no, absolutely.
But that didn't keep her from apparently being a hottie. So, you know.
Yep. It's a different world, my friend.
Yep. So, but yeah, heavy metal was in a lot of post-apoc in the late 70s, early 80s. And obviously, I did not read nearly enough of them. But being 12 or 13, it was a lot harder to get a hold of heavy metal for us.
I was just about to say, it was hard to find most copies of heavy metal back in the, especially growing up in a small town in Mississippi like we did. It was really hard to find some of that stuff.
Yeah, they weren't in Walden books for some reason. I don't know why.
I mean, our town was small enough that if an EMP had wiped out most of the world, we would have not have been affected.
Somebody might have come in and told us about it in a month or so, but yeah, they wouldn't have even canceled school.
No, not at all. I wanted to bring something up. Some of the fun stuff that I was reading in some of his reviews, he talks about bikers a lot because obviously bikers is a trope, right? And One of the quotes that he has, I thought was interesting because, you know, you're like, why bike? Why is it always bikers? Why does it have to be bikers? Well, so his quote is, when civilization did an ugly disappearing act called World War III, men already used to the lack of it stood the best chance of survival. And the Hell's Angels were survivors from way back. So, I mean, he points out the fact that bikers are kind of used to living, not necessarily off the land, but they don't really fit into society. And they're used to being kind of their own closed, protective group who's got each other's backs. And I mean, if anyone's going to have a chance from day one, it's probably going to be someone that's already armed to the teeth, used to traveling around, used to kind of living from day to day. And so, I mean, it does make a lot of sense. But he does later on talk about some of the reasons why he doesn't necessarily like the biker trope, because one of the books he's talking about, he said the bicycle gang named themselves the Bloodsuckers. The names were so outrageous. Black Donut, the Viking, San Quentin Sal, Billy Bullshit, Ivan the Terrible, Zoyas, and Rockmer. And it's just like, where do people come up with this?
Movies.
I don't know if I want to be a biker named Black Donut. I'm not like, I think I'd come up with a more menacing name than that.
Black Donut. Well, maybe that's his nickname. Everybody gave it to him because of a dreadful accident with a donut.
A dreadful accident. We all call him Black Donut, but not to his face because...
And he doesn't want to talk about it. But yeah, I don't remember what book it was, but yeah, in that article, he's talking about a series where part of the Soviet attack on the United States was pumping clouds, gas warfare of hallucinogenic, druggy gas. And because bikers have been taking drugs for so long, it doesn't really affect them very much. So they're semi-immune. So that was awesome. Cool. But I'm glad to see on the whole he likes bikers because that's cool.
Well, and he's also being honest. I mean, the bikers appear in almost every one of these series in one form or another. So I think it's realistic to and important to acknowledge the fact that they really are oftentimes the main villain or the main villain's bodyguards in a lot of these series. So I think that's very reasonable. One thing I found interesting about the David Robbins interview was at one point he made a comment where the interviewer basically said that in one of your series, you tend to kill off a lot of the main characters. How did this go down with readers? And his response is basically some fans really disagreed with the rate of this and some of the stupidest, it was one of the stupidest ideas I ever had. And essentially, he says he was going for realism, but at some point, you're reading a series and you're developing a bond with a favorite character or favorite characters. And if they're just being killed as kind of an off the plot point just to prove that no one's safe. I mean, it's almost like reading a book based on the HBO series Game of Thrones, right? And obviously, George R. R. Martin has the series that he wrote as well, but he basically kills off main characters all the time for no reason.
Especially if the fans like them.
Especially if the fans like, exactly. So I thought it was interesting that David Robbins kind of bemoaned the fact that that was a decision that he was kind of forced into and he really regretted doing that. I thought that was kind of a neat read.
Well, at least he didn't kill off any dogs, which I still get grief for. But anyway.
Yeah.
Point I want to bring up, he has an interview with the Doomsday Prepper specialist Jim Cobb in there, because Jim Cobb is not only a prepper instructor, but was also a big fan of 70s, 80s, early 90s men's adventure books. I just want to put a plug in for him and his podcast, Library at the End of the World. Now, it's not running anymore. It stopped like a couple of years ago. He put it on hiatus, but it has 98 episodes. And in almost every episode, he interviews an author for a little while, and they talk a bit about their post-apoc novels. It's real useful to find new stuff. I found it very helpful in finding new books. That's how I discovered Ashfall by Mike Mullins and some others. He interviews Jerry Ahern's wife, David Robbins, and some others. So good plug. And he's a prepper, but he's a reasonable prepper. So I like that about him.
Yeah, I was actually just going to bring that up. One of the things that he said, they ask, how do you define the term prepper? And he basically, because there's this misconception that a prepper is basically, it's someone in an underground bunker waiting for a nuclear apocalypse.
The 80s stereotype of the survivalist.
Right, exactly. But he said a prepper is essentially, it's just a term for anyone who worked towards being better prepared for life's little and maybe not so little curveballs. So, I mean, there's all different levels of preppers. And because we kind of touched on prepper fiction last week in the last podcast, and I had mentioned that it wasn't one of my favorite types of novels to read, but I wanted to just apologize if I offended anyone by saying that, because what I was doing is I was equating preppers with people that were essentially living in bunkers, writing out the end of the world. So I apologize if I stepped on anyone's toes. With those
disconnecting
comments.
Doc Benny from the call. Oh, just kidding. There's reasonable preppers. The crazy guy who's locked himself in a basement with 100 guns and two rolls of toilet paper waiting for the government to come get him. I don't find that. Some people like that kind of fiction, and that's cool, but I don't personally. But yeah, check out his podcast. The episodes aren't very long. They're only about 30, 40 minutes, so. And then he gives like a 3-minute survival tip at the end. That's kind of cool to get some pragmatic stuff. And they don't just cover books, by the way. They cover some movies and they cover comics.
Oh, nice.
And I used to read Judge Dredd, and I had never compared the Cursed Earth Saga with Damnation Alley. And they do in this book, and it just kind of clicked into my head. Why didn't I see that? Only they were going from Megacity 1 across to California rather than the other way around. But they even had an ex-biker driving the vehicle, trying to get through to rescue people from the Tutti Frutti disease. T-U-T-I-F-R-T-I,
It raises, it raises an interesting point where even if you're coming up with an idea and you're writing a book or you're trying to incorporate something that you're thinking of, you're going to be influenced to some degree by something that you may have read or may have seen. So, you know, they say there are no original ideas anymore, right? I mean, So is it possible that one was influenced by the other? Absolutely. Was it intentionally plagiarized or anything like that? That's a much more gray area. I mean, there are only so many new situations or scenarios that you can come up with, because most stuff has already been put out in some way, shape, or form.
And besides, the movie Damnation Alley with George Peppard and Jan Michael Vincent, I mean, it was different noticeably from the book. They say in Pulp Apocalypse, one of the authors says, you know, one wonders why they even bothered getting the rights to begin with, because It was so different that they could have just made it a movie and said, you know, Hell Alley or The Death of America or something like that. It would have been just fine, because everybody went to see Damnation Alley. You know, none of them, I'm sure, read the novella that was put out by Zelazny.
Right.
So, but yeah, this book, it isn't that expensive. It's like, you know, $12 or so, depending on if you can get a deal at Amazon. It's available. It is not available on Kindle, which disappoints me a bit, but you can get it as a hard copy. It's perfect bound. It's got a lot of good photos in it too, doesn't it? I mean, I'm just guessing, obviously.
I was just going to mention that it does a really good job of capturing the artwork of all the different covers. So you can kind of get a feel for how different authors and different artists wanted to kind of portray the main characters. Although the main characters always look the same, right? They look like some cross between Snake Plissken and you know, some really chisel-chinned actor of your choice, except for the hombre, of course. But the problem that I have, and we touched on this briefly earlier this week, is that the names drive me crazy. The name, like, everyone, no one has a gentle sounding name. There is no Bob. Everyone's like Mike. John, Roxon, Rick.
Tank Concrete.
The women's names always have to make it sound like they're walking right out of a centerfold.
Or a strip club.
Or a strip club, right. And so yeah. Candy and Vixen.
Well, to be fair, one of the authors in the Deathlands series made fun of that at one point, where the main character, Squeeze, Christy Roth, she's this tall, big breasted redhead, and this crazed general captures her for her to be his mate and thus create superior children. And she just rolls her eyes and says, I don't know where you warlords get the idea that being red-haired and big-boobed somehow will result in you having superior children. I'm like, thank you.
Yeah, the superior race idea. I think that's just a cover for...
I want this hot redhead.
Exactly. Yeah, I think that's the honest truth. But yeah, I enjoy stories more. I tend to get into them a little bit more and identify with the characters a little bit more if their names aren't overly the top obnoxious.
Chunk Beef Slab.
Chunk Beef Slab.
Yeah. It I don't recall it bothering us as much when we were 14.
Well, and so that also raises another point, is who's your audience, right?
Right.
That might be your audience's preference.
Yeah. So know your audience if you're writing. That's the takeaway here. But yeah, we advise pick it up. It's really cool. Visit Paperback Warrior's site. He covers all sorts of vintage pulp, not just men's adventure novels from the 70s and 80s. So you can go to read other pulp stuff. Don't know why, since Pulp Epoch is perfect, but you know, you might.
I do give it 2 thumbs up. Yes, it was very enjoyable.
Yeah. 2 mushroom clouds. Yeah.
2 mushrooms out of 3. Yep.
That tastes great together. Yeah. All right. Well, this has been our episode. We hope everyone's enjoyed it and you found out something interesting about the book. And so we will let you all go back into the wasteland. But remember, always keep one hand on the steering wheel
and the other hand on your shotgun.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
And we're out.
It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it.